The glycans are basically the third layer of complexity when it comes to biologic molecules. Like in the beginning of the 1990s, there was this huge twist in the pharmaceutical industry that, wow, the own molecules of the body could be used in a therapeutic fashion.
Hey, smart scientists. Welcome to another episode of the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast. Glycosylation matters in various therapeutic fields. And today I'm having a conversation with Henning van Horsten, who is a professor of industrial bioengineering at the University of Applied Sciences in Berlin, with a focus on the GMP-compliant manufacturing of biopharmaceutical drug substances derived from animal cell culture. And we are talking about why glycosylation matters and how we can tweak glycosylation, or in other words, engineer, in order to change the properties of various biological entities. So stay tuned for an exciting conversation. Are you juggling the complexities of CMC development while trying to enjoy the beauty of biotech? Have you ever wondered if there's a way to simplify bioprocessing? Welcome to the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast, where we're diving headfirst into the very challenges you face. We're breaking it down, demystifying the jargon, and giving you the keys to unlock your full potential. I'm your host, David Brohlman, and I get it. With 15 plus years in the biotech industry, I face the same challenges you do. There's a way to simplify and streamline so you can remove complexity, you can skip trials and errors, deliver without delay your groundbreaking therapy to clinics and market, and still enjoy every single step. Do you want to learn how industry experts and I did it? Grab a cup of coffee and your favorite notebook and pen. Now is the time to take your bioprocessing game to the next level. Let's smarten up biotech. Henning, welcome to the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here today and look forward to our nice interview. As I mentioned before, the glycan experts are here. So, yeah, it's good to talk to you.
It's a big pleasure to have you on and talk about glycosylation. So before we talk about glycosylation, Henning, share something that you believe about bioprocess development that most people disagree with.
I have a crazy future vision, and it is also related to glycans. I believe that there is a huge disrupting potential in the use of yeast cells. And there has already been done some work by some scientists in Belgium and elsewhere where they have come up with yeast strains that can have truncated types of glycans. And I believe that the trend in the pharmaceutical industry will go towards obtaining molecules which are completely defined homogeneous. And to achieve that, that can rather be achieved by chemistry and not biology. And so I think the yeast will have a huge potential and will finally replace CHO cells. Right now, I know the legacy products will remain being made in animal cell culture, but yeah, it makes sense for future drugs to save manufacturing costs to go with an organism that can double every 90 minutes and generate a lot of biomass and also recombinant protein in a properly folded fashion. So why do we need expensive cell culture media and animal cell culture, which is far too expensive to make drugs which should like serve the world? If we talk about moving drug manufacturing to Africa and other countries, it is also important to bring down the cost of goods manufactured. And to get there, I think we will soon, or not soon, maybe in 10, 20 years, see yeast replacing CHO culture. I hope many will disagree, particularly those who are currently engaged in the field.
Yeah, smart biotech scientists, let us know what you think about what will be the future in 10 to 20 years. I would love to hear your thoughts on that. So tell us a bit why you got started and how you got started in biotech. And now, what are you doing currently and how did you get there?
Oh, yeah, it's a long and checkered way how I got there. I was always interested in chemistry. I loved chemistry from the time I had the first lecture in chemistry in high school, and I always wanted to be a chemist. And by some twist of fate, I ended up studying not only chemistry, but also biology. And biology turned out to be the chemistry of life. And it kind of got me excited even more. And then, of course, I had to find a way to make a livelihood from my passion. To do that, I first moved to Hamburg, got a PhD from Hamburg University, and I worked there. I worked for the Institute for Hormone and Fertility Research, which was a subsidiary of Schering AG, which no longer exists. And after that, I did my postdoc in academia at Texas Tech University in Texas, in the US. And after returning there from my first postdoc, I decided that I have to move to industry to really have a plannable career, and makes more sense. It's a bit of a gamble to think you could make it in academia without doing the right things, which I didn't. So I found my way into industry after returning from the US, and I first started at the business development department at Probiogen AG, which is a large contract development and manufacturing organization in Berlin. And from there, I also graduated into different roles. And finally, I was working directly for the CSO, and my role was a project and technology manager. And him and I, we were big sparring partners and also invented many cool things together, also technologies pertaining to glycosylation. So we will talk about that later. And I worked at the company for, I think, 7-8 years. In any good marriage, 7 years is more than enough. And then I decided I need some greener pastures and check what I could do. But there were also some boring positions in companies and large corporations, and they didn't appeal to me. I felt a bit pigeonholed there, or it would be a pigeonholed type of role. So I thought maybe I should go back to teach. I like students. I'm an extroverted person, like to stand in front of students, help them also grow their careers. So teaching appealed to me, and also research. And luckily, I had the possibility to work at the University of Applied Science here in Berlin, HTW, HTW Berlin, which is the largest University of Applied Science here in Berlin. 14,000 students. I'm in the life science engineering department since 2013. So it's a long, long time, 11 years ago. And since then, I've built my own research group. I have currently a postdoc, a senior scientist, and PhD student, and also a lot of bachelor and master students all the time who work on projects. The twist is at HTW, I'm working a lot with companies on joint projects because we are not really getting access to the traditional sort of funding. I was able to secure a DFG grant once, but it was luck. The main source of income for research for us is small and medium enterprises and joint projects from the BMBF or BMWK funding.
Wow, it's exciting. What I love hearing your story, and now have the opportunity to interview people from all kinds of different backgrounds, what I see is that oftentimes it's not linear. We start somewhere and then we end up somewhere completely different, and it's not linear at all. That's amazing. Let's start about talking about our passion, which is glycosylation. As an introduction for those people who are not so familiar, can you explain what is the importance of the glycan composition as a CQA?
Yeah, the glycans are basically the third layer of complexity when it comes to biologic molecules. Like in the beginning of the 1990s, there was this huge twist in the pharmaceutical industry that, wow, the own molecules of the body could be used in a therapeutic fashion. For example, interferons came up, and also the monoclonal antibodies. And these molecules are made by the body itself to protect against illness. And this potential was recognized by the pharmaceutical industry. And then originally, back in the 90s, the perception was, okay, I have a gene, I have an mRNA, and then I get a protein. The classic dogma of biology, molecular biology. And nobody really considered the post-translational modifications back at that time. And glycans were early discovered as a post-translational modification of increasing complexity. There is N-glycans, which are branched and large and different antennarity and terminal sugars. And the composition of sugars is also very complex. And back in the 90s, it was kind of, yeah, it's there, but the protein does its function without it. No? An enzyme works without the glycans involvement. An antibody will bind its target without the glycans involvement. It's complex, but yeah, not worry about it. And then people try to discover, what is it about the glycans? Do they have an impact on the drug quality? And the pharmaceutical industry, I think, had a big impact on this, because the pharmaceutical industry has a big focus on efficacy, safety, and uniformity of a drug when it is synthesized. Uniformity is, of course, an issue. That the glycan heterogeneity is something that goes against uniformity. So the people try to see, do we really have to worry about this lack of uniformity with regard to the glycans, or do we have to worry about it? And the biggest worry in pharma is, does it have an impact on efficacy, on safety? So they were first looking at, what do these glycans do? Are they important? Are they not? And then it was discovered that the glycans composition is important. Sialylation plays a role. The sialic acids are those glycans which are anionic, and they sit on the top, the terminal ends of each. If you consider a glycan to be a tree, on the top, the leaves are the top leaves that poke out are the sialic acids. And they can fall off like leaves in autumn. And when that happens, a protein that has lost its leaves will then bind to the liver and be destroyed and taken away from circulation. So the pharmacokinetic property of these molecules is then reduced. It is no longer there, and then it can't do its good action on the body. So sialylation was early recognized as an attribute of glycosylation that is important to monitor and to keep to the utmost level. And in particular, a case in point is epoetin, EPO, a molecule that is glycosylated. The original EPO molecule from the body carries three glycans, N-glycans. And then later it was discovered these glycans are so beneficial for the pharmacokinetic behavior of the molecules, they added another one. And darbepoetin alpha now has four N-glycosylation sites. And ideally, they should be totally sialylated in an ideal world, which they are never, because the complexity of processing animal cells is working against homogeneous sialylation. But yeah, so this was one big thing. And then it was clear, yes, we need to monitor glycosylation. And the other case is fucosylation, which turned out to not only have an impact on pharmacokinetics, but also on pharmacodynamic action of an antibody.
Now, Henning, you mentioned that glycans have an impact on efficacy and also the safety of the stability of the molecule. So if we take now this a step further, because what the pharmaceutical industry is doing, they're modifying or tuning these glycans. Can you tell us a bit more how you do that and how do you enhance the properties of therapeutic proteins?
Although this is a question early on that has popped up once it was discovered that the glycans are really important when it comes to the efficacy of drug substance. Of course, engineers in the biopharmaceutical industry tried to design processes in such a way that they would end up getting a product with ideal glycosylation attributes. The big issue with this is that the machinery inside the cells is really, really complex. First of all, we have the sugar nucleotide metabolism. So the sugar nucleotides are the activated sugars needed by the enzymes to build these huge glycosylation trees. And it's also a eukaryotic cell is also compartmentalized, where the synthesis of these large glycans happens inside the membrane enclosed compartments, the Golgi, the ER, and the sugar nucleotides have to penetrate from the cytosolic compartment where they are synthesized. They go and travel through the membrane, through unique transporters into the lumen of the Golgi and ER. And there they get used as a substrate to build these glycans. You can imagine how complex that is. And if you think about a cell doubling every 24 hours in a manufacturing process, and there's biomass synthesis that's needed for the cells doubling, and everything is competing for ATP and energy resources and also for the sugars that come in, and the primary catabolism that degrades glucose is not only the source of energy, but it's also the source of the sugar nucleotides that are made for glycosylation. So there's competition between glycosylation and the synthesis activity and growth activity of animal cells, which makes it really complex to get all in once. You can get a high titer of the desired target molecule, but then the glycan attribute will go down in quality. Or you get a low output, but high quality glycan composition. and vice versa. So this is a conundrum that needed to be tackled, and it's really, really difficult. And also the biggest thing with animal cell culture is also these cancer cells that divide every 24 hours come with a twist. They are suffering from metabolic uncoupling of the glycolysis and the TCA cycle. So they are not very efficient in getting enough ATP from any mole of glucose. So this is also another big problem.
Now, given this huge complexity to engineer glycans, can you tell us what are the different strategies we have at our disposal and what are the advantages and drawbacks of each of them?
The first things that were done were composition, as a media composition engineering. Like a lot of people at Genentech, they started to add manganese and nucleotides and galactose to feed into different parts of the metabolism to level up the pool of available sugar nucleotide per given point in time. And it turned out to work to a certain extent, but not really to a maximum. As a chemist, we would like to get things complete conversion in a reaction. And biology is the enemy of us, us chemists. So yeah, it is complicated, I would say. So this were the first approaches to try to engineer the media. And then there were approaches to engineer cell lines. And I think the lowest hanging fruits were the engineering of the lack of a glycan. So Fucose, for example, turned out to be a double-edged sword. It is sometimes a good sugar, sometimes not. And to get rid of it is quite easy. You just need to delete the enzyme that attaches it to the growing glycan structure. This has been done. So one strategy to get rid of Fucose was to create a knockout of a cell line and deleting the fucosyl transferase 8, for example, to just get rid of it. So that's possible. The deletion is a strategy that works very well and very complete, but it comes with its perks. There's problems with this. There might be off-target effects when designing a construct that has a specified deletion. The deletion might not be there only at that point in the genome, but elsewhere, and it may affect growth of the cells. So this was another strategy that had to be done, but unfortunately, it didn't help to get to a higher level of complexity. And then people tried to engineer glycosyl transferases into the molecule, galactosylation, to enhance galactosylation. But again, that is so complex. It's not doable by just increasing the amount of galactosyl transferase. It's also important to elevate the transporter activity and the synthesis activity in the cytosolic compartment. And UDP galactose is part of the Lalois cycle. It gets turned around into glucose and vice versa. So it is by far not easy to engineer glycans in a living cell.
Yeah, it's definitely complex.
Yes, the most recent, recent is also 10 years ago, but the most recent advancement in that regard was the synthesis of glycans as oxazolines and then using them as a substrate for transglycosylation. Like you can synthesize any kind of protein with a shitty glycan and then just add the nice glycan in excess and link it then to the structure. And this, I think, holds the biggest promise. If we make any inroads in synthesizing N-glycans in a commercially feasible way, then this would be the total game changer for the entire industry. This is my outrageous future outlook.
My question now, Henning, because what we want in the biopharma industry, we want one consistency. So we want to produce the same molecule over and over, but that's a big challenge because we're dealing with living cells. And not only want to do that in the lab where it's, let's say, easier than in a large scale facility. So how do we do that? How do we develop technologies that are consistent and we can scale up into a larger scale production?
This is a very, very good question. You're touching on the biggest and most complex type of bioprocessing that is available, which is scaling up and scaling down. And it may seem simple to people who have just worked in the lab. Typically, we come from a background where we have worked in a molecular biology lab or in a cell culture lab, and we just cultured cells at small scale and never had to worry about, do my cells get enough oxygen? What's the KLA of the molecule, of the reactor? So those questions never pop up. But in the end, we have to think about scaling up the process. And this means lab scale cannot directly be transferred into large scale. I can't just take an Erlenmeyer and shake it at 100 milliliters and then build an Erlenmeyer and shake it at 1,000 liter. It doesn't make sense. No? So to move to 1,000 liters, I would need to have a stirred tank reactor type. Then I need to worry about shear force. What kind of impeller am I using? What kind of fluid dynamics shall I have there? Axial or radial transport? Do I need a marine impeller? Do I need a Russian impeller? What kind of impeller type gets the biggest power entry? What about KLA? Do I get enough oxygen? Which reactor setting is best for that? But yeah, but if the cells get oxygen, do they get sheared? If I crash down the bubbles too hard, I might also crash the cells. Wow. So it's a nightmare. And it's equally complex as the engineering of the cell itself. I would think, at least think so. Yeah. And unfortunately, there's also conflicting, Ziel conflict, target aim conflict. For example, mixing time. If you want to reduce the mixing time and make sure the nutrients get there quickly, then I have to increase the power entry. But power entry then also increases impeller tip speed and the cells get sheared. And yeah, nightmare. I need consulting for this, by the way, if I ever get there.
Yeah, that's good. That's exactly what we are doing. We are helping scientists master the transition from the lab to the large-scale facility because, as you said, it's highly complex. Hey, smart biotech scientists. I hope you have gotten as much value out of our conversation with Henning von Horsten as I have. Henning von Horsten is a professor of industrial bioengineering at the University of Applied Sciences in Berlin, Germany. And in part two, he's going to tell us the story of how he and his collaborators invented a smart way of modulating antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity. And we're also talking about glycan analysis. So stay tuned, and I see you in part two. All right, smart scientists. That's all for today on the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast. Thank you for tuning in and joining us on your journey to bioprocess mastery. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. By doing so, we can empower more scientists like you. For additional bioprocessing tips, visit us at smartbiotechscientist.com. Stay tuned for more inspiring biotech insights in our next episode. Until then, let's continue to smarten up biotech.